Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Scent holds memories, sparks them, brings them back. We all know that. And some scents come in a bottle. If Chanel No. 5 could talk, what a story it would tell. What memories of an orphan girl as Tsarina's perfume, Nazis, wartime, fox furs and hats, and American GIs bringing a little bottle from Paris home to special gals. It's history, culture, desire in a bottle. This hour On Point, the remarkable story of Coco Chanel and her number 5 perfume. You can join the conversation. Do you know it, wear it, wore it, did she? What's this scent, this history say to you? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from New York is Tilar Matseo, cultural historian, professor of English at Colby College, writer-in-residence this year at George Washington University. Her new book is The Secret of Chanel No. 5, The Intimate History of the World's Most Famous Perfume. Tilar Matseo, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks, Tom. A pleasure to be here.
Professor of English, cultural historian of all things writing about a perfume? Why?
Yeah, I know how to pick my research subjects, don't I? I spent some time in Paris. But seriously, Chanel, my niche as a scholar and cultural historian is on French luxury products and on really the way in which luxury products define us historically and how they have an impact on the development of culture and history. So I had written a book earlier on the history of Veuve Clicquot Champagne, the Widow Clicquot, and after I had finished writing that and had thought a lot about wine and the wine appreciation is also about smell in a way, I thought, well, I know what makes a great wine. I wonder what makes a great perfume. And, of course, the greatest perfume out there is Chanel No. 5. So that was when my interest in it began.
French luxury products, how luxury products define us. Who's us in that case? Does it define us whether or not we're wearing the fox furs, the minks, wearing the Chanel No. 5?
Well, yeah. I mean, if from an academic perspective, you know, if you look at, this is very heavy information, but if you're looking at something like Marxist cultural theory, what a Marxist would say is absolutely that the culture and the economic structure that we live in tells us who we should aspire to be. And advertising is really at the heart of that, right? It tells us, you know, if you buy this perfume, you too will be sexy and gorgeous. So at the most basic level, it's those kinds of questions I'm interested in.
I'm looking here at an amazing photograph right in the front of your book of Marilyn Monroe, who famously said what Chanel No. 5 was all she wore to bed, a couple drops of that, and it looks like she's in a bedroom. She's in some, I don't know, gold lamé gown maybe, and she is doing that Marilyn Monroe with her fingertips. It looks like taking the perfume right across her throat, bosom. Wow, they really knew how to. If a Marxist looked at this, they would see the power of capitalism at work. I suppose.
That's it. If I could buy Chanel No. 5 and look like that, I'd have a bathtub of it, wouldn't you?
Maybe. I don't suppose it takes that much. The real story, you call this the biography of a scent. In a way, it is also, of course, the biography of Coco Chanel, who had so much to do with the creation and bringing to the world of this particular scent. But before we get to that story, can you just tell us something about what's in it? A producer, a colleague of mine, brought in a bottle here sitting on the table. I haven't seen one in a long time, with that very familiar rich golden color and that very distinctive scent. What makes this perfume smell the way it does?
As perfumes go, it is one of the genuinely important modernist creations. So what Chanel does, Number 5 does, is that on the one hand, it has a series of very, very heavy, languid, incredibly culturally coded as sensual scents.
A sort of deep
like
bottom
musk.
Scent to it. Mm-hmm.
Right. Lots of musk. It has jasmine, and jasmine has a large proportion of something called indoles is the chemical in them. Mm. And indoles are the scent of, you know, something a little bit overripe. And then it has May Rose from Grasse in the south of France, mm-hmm. which is where, you know, really the perfume industry began. And those are all considered quite heavy, provocative scents. And especially in the 1920s, those were considered positively racy scents, that that would not be what a genteel young woman would wear.
Okay.
And then balancing it, and this is really what makes it such an important creation in the history of scent, is a group of materials called aldehydes. And aldehydes are really actually easy to understand. If you take a bottle of wine and you leave it on the counter, and you know how it eventually turns to vinegar?
Yes, sure.
Well, when an aldehyde oxidizes to an acid, in that case acetic acid or vinegar, aldehydes are the natural middle stage. And so the thing is that, you know, aldehydes are all around us. They happen anytime an alcohol turns into an acid, and they have these very fresh, clean scents like soap or citrus. And so what happened in the beginning of the 20th century is that scientists learned how to stabilize aldehydes so that you could use them in scent materials.
And capture that sort of transitional scent and hold it.
Exactly. And that was really the innovation. So it's not that aldehydes, you know, this thing about it's synthetic, right? Mm-hmm. We always talk about Chanel No. 5 is one of the first synthetic perfumes. And it's synthetic only really in that sense, that it let aldehydes be used. And so what aldehydes do is they actually lift the fragrance, and they kind of tickle your nose, basically. Mm-hmm. So they give you that fresh, clean, bracing scent, but also an experience of cleanliness.
Something that Coco Chanel wanted, something that she took right back to her time in what, the convent orphanage, the smell of soap and laundry.
Exactly. So she grew up in this convent, but she begins her career as, you know, essentially a kept woman. So for her, you know, that's part of what I thought was interesting, is that her sexuality in lots of ways is really tied up with, you know, what does it mean to wear the heavy scents of a woman who's openly sexual in a modern kind of way, and also be clean and fresh and stylish.
That's the modern balance, I guess, every woman in the 20th century was trying to hang on to in many ways.
Exactly.
When people describe Chanel No. 5, and I know listeners will do it for us, they're lining up already to do it, but what's the vocabulary that comes out? What are the words that capture what this is about?
Yeah, I think that for most people, it's the freshness of the clean scrubbedness of it. As the first note, you know, some people talk about it as a kind of champagne experience in the very beginning, which, of course, I always like. And then underneath that is this, you know, longer lasting, the rose and the jasmine and the musks, really. I mean, there is a little bit of vanilla. There are a series of other notes that people will talk about. But I think most people who talk about it, interestingly, don't talk about it. People tend to talk about Chanel No. 5 because it's an icon, not in terms of the particular notes, but in terms of the way it makes them feel. I mean, over and over again, when I talk to people, it's like, it makes me feel confident. It makes me feel sexy. So that's, for me, the interesting part of it, is that we move so quickly to how we think about our own identity when we talk about Chanel No. 5.
I associate it, maybe I'm wrong, but I associate it with decades back. Maybe that's when I knew women who were wearing it. Lately, not so much, though those memories are very strong. But is it as, how popular did it become? How popular is it today?
Well, Chanel, the corporation of Chanel, the perfume house, is famously private. It's still a privately held company. And so they understandably don't talk about any kind of sales figures at all. But according to the French embassy, their estimate is that currently a bottle of Chanel No. 5 sells somewhere in the world every 30 seconds. And it is, so there's no question that it's an incredible economy of desire in the present moment. And when it was launched in the 1920s, by 1929, it had become the best-selling perfume in the world. So for almost 90 years, it has been very, very close to the best-selling perfume in the world every year for those decades.
The roots, you write, go back to Russia, maybe through one lover of Coco Chanel.
Right. No, it's the roots definitely go back to Russia. There are some scientists working in Switzerland at Givaudan, which is one of the big perfume and scent manufacturing companies. And they've done some incredibly interesting research where what they've done is analyzed Chanel No. 5 and also some of the perfumes that I'm sure we'll talk about later that she produced to imitate Chanel No. 5. After the Second World War, when she was in this battle with the partners who owned the company. And they've done an analysis of these fragrances and compared them to an earlier fragrance that was produced in 1914 in Russia called Bouquet de Catherine. And then that perfume was a flop on the Russian market and was later re-released under the name of Rallet No. 1. and they've compared the chemical structures of them, and it was the same perfumer who created Chanel No. 5, Rallet No. 1, and Bouquet de Catherine, a man named Ernest Beau. And it's very clear, based on the science, that what he was doing with Chanel No. 5 was reformulating and reimagining an earlier perfume that had been created to celebrate the Russian czarinas that had not been successful in Russia.
Talk about an exotic story here. That perfumer introduced what perhaps to Coco Chanel by Dmitri Pavlovich, a lover of hers, a cousin to Tsar Nicholas II, in exile in Paris after conspiring to assassinate Rasputin. And in the middle of all that, we have Chanel No. 5. Tilar Matseo is with us. Her new book is The Secret of Chanel No. 5, The Intimate History of the World's Most Famous Perfume. She's a cultural historian, and there is a lot of history buried right here in this story, in this scent. Here's Marie Chevalier with Fleur de Paris. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
C'est une fleur de chez nous. Elle a fleuri de partout. Car c'est la fleur du retour des beaux jours. Pendant quatre ans, dans nos cœurs, elle a gardé ses couleurs. Bleu, blanc, rouge, elle était vraiment avant tout fleur de chez nous.
We're talking this hour about the story of Chanel No. 5, the classic scent, and its tale of convent, mistress, orphan, Nazis, jasmine and rose petals. Tilar Matseo is with us. She's written the new book, The Secret of Chanel No. 5. She calls it the biography of a scent. And this is a scent that has really traveled. Tilar Matseo joins us from New York. Let's have just a little bit of the voice of Coco Chanel here in her first televised interview. This was with the designer in her office, 1959. She was asked, we'll hear the French here, I'll give a little interpretation, how she would define elegance.
Une définition de l'élégance. On dit que c'est difficile, on pose des questions bien difficiles. Parce que c'est que l'élégance. Beaucoup de choses, vous savez.
And what a voice. You can hear the Moulin Rouge and everything else working there. She says the definition of elegance, oh my God, this is hard. You're asking tough questions. It's about a lot of things. And I'll tell you, I always repeat, she says, it's a fact. Women are always overdressed and never elegant enough. That's a pretty broad interpretation, but you can get the heart of her message. Here's Catherine Deneuve in the 1970s, French actress. She was the face of Chanel No. 5. Here she is in one of those ads.
What I really love is intimacy. How you created it's a woman's pleasure. Like Chanel No. 5, bath powder and spray cologne. Chanel, it's one of the pleasures of being a woman.
And boy, has it been marketed over the years. Tilar, we've got lots of callers. I want to get right to them. People who know it, maybe right on the wrist, right on the throat. Nancy in Williamstown, Vermont. You're on the air, Nancy.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I've been wearing Chanel No. 5 for over 30 years. I grew up with it. My mother introduced me to it as a small child. It was her signature scent. And she always taught me that whether it's clothing or perfume, you buy classics, you buy things that last a long time and that are simple and elegant. And so I've always loved Chanel No. 5. I have worn a few other fragrances over the year, but I always come back to Chanel, and I always get it as a gift. It's the one thing every Christmas that I pray for and receive. And I just wanted to make a quick point, which is I did not know that the story behind Coco, and this might only be interesting to me, but my mother, too, was an orphan and raised in a convent, so I just find that very interesting.
Maybe a little touch of the laundry soap there reached out to her as well, Nancy.
Maybe, and I just absolutely love Chanel No. 5. I love to wear it. It makes me feel just beautiful, and I constantly get compliments on how I smell.
Let me ask you something. You say classic, simple, elegant. What about the sexy part? I'm looking at Marilyn Monroe put it on here. She's got that going. Is that part of what you work with in it?
Absolutely, and I think for my, you know, again, as being raised, you know, my mom always tried to express to me that you can be sexy without being overly sexual, and so I think it's sort of something that's very sensual, and it definitely makes me feel just beautiful when I wear it, and I smell my own wrists, and I love to smell my coat, and so yeah, I think it's all of that. I just think it's understated, even though it's a strong scent. There's something in the mix of the elements that just I think make it not overpowering, but just something really yummy. And I also love rose, so I think that might be a big piece of it.
Nancy Boyd, do you know it well or not? It really comes across. Thank you very much for that. I love it. And let me get one more to Lauren, and I'll bring it to you. But sure. Jenny in Chesapeake, Virginia. Jenny, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My sister's boyfriend was stationed in France during the Second World War. Mm. And he would send back Chanel No. 5 to her in packages. And in order to keep it from evaporating across the ocean, he would melt candle wax around the seal of it. So, and sometimes it would leak in transit, and we would love to get those packages from France. And so it's always been my favorite. It's still on my dressing table and will always be there.
Did it make him a war hero, sending that home from France in wartime, Jenny?
He was our hero. Yes, he was.
And do you recall, was the scent something new or different to you, or was it just one more perfume in the row?
Well, I think that a perfume from France is going to be sexy no matter what. And it was the perfect perfume from France. And so she saved it until he got back from overseas. And so I'm sure it was very sexy for her. I was very young at the time, but she was ready to marry him, which she did.
Yeah, no doubt. That's a wonderful story, Jenny. Thank you so much. Tilar, Jenny's, brother-in-law, I guess, there, and many more GIs in World War II snatched this up. I mean, Germans did it first after they invaded France, then Americans after they pushed them back. Everybody wanted to take this home.
Yeah, Jenny, that's a great story. And, you know, the thing that is wonderful about Chanel No. 5 is that that story is played out over and over again so many times. So, you know, really, Chanel No. 5, by the 20s, is already a best-selling perfume. But it's in that five-year period of the Second World War that it really becomes the icon that it is now. And most of the reason why is because it ends up being distributed through the U.S. Army commissaries. So people like this GI soldier can buy it and can send it back to girlfriends and can send it back to, you know, mothers and people they're courting, and can buy it for Parisian girls that they want to seduce perhaps as well after the liberation. So it's really during the Second World War that it becomes this amazing icon, and in part is also because of what our first caller was talking about, which is the idea that, you know, you buy something classic. Well, already then it was classic, but also think about the Second World War and the kind of deprivation that there was at the time. And if you go out and buy a bottle of perfume as a luxury, it's a luxury that you can wear and enjoy every day, but that lasts a long time.
Yeah.
So it's sort of luxury concentrated in a way that even at a moment of, you know, of shortages and deprivation, you can kind of justify in your mind as the one indulgence.
And you can stretch it out and you can make it last. Take us back then to the story, because it is a great story. Many people know a lot about Coco Chanel, but even starting right there, what her mother had died of tuberculosis, her father takes her to the orphanage. Take us right through. We've got the perfume out and on here. Tilar, give us the story of how she grew up to go after this, how she created this.
Right. It's a pretty amazing story. I mean, so she grows up in a convent called Aubusine in the southwest of France, where I did go and visit and was able to see, you know, where she grew up. Mm-hmm. And it's an incredibly stark Cistercian monastery that becomes an orphanage up in the mountains. And her mother dies when she's young, and her father just abandons the kids. Mm-hmm. The sons he sends out to work and the daughters he sends to the orphanage at the convent. And so she and her sisters grow up there and are taught to be seamstresses, basically. So that's part of, you know, how she gets her launch in the world of fashion, is that she's trained to become a seamstress. And at 18, she has to decide, am I going to become a nun or am I not going to become a nun? And nobody thought that Coco Chanel was going to become a nun at 18. And so instead, she becomes basically a cabaret dancer, and then she becomes the mistress of a whole series of different men.
Was she literally at the Moulin Rouge, or is it we just imagined that?
No, she was never at the Moulin Rouge, but because she was in a small provincial town in southwest France.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, but she was at those small provincial towns equivalents of the Moulin Rouge, and she started having love affairs with, you know, the officers who were stationed there, and later with a series
What years are we talking here?
These are in the teens.
Okay.
And so...
So we're talking World War One officers, or...
That's right. Mm-hmm, okay. Yeah, that's right. And so she has a love affair with a man named Boy Capel, Arthur Capel, who's an Englishman. And the evidence is that by 1919, she's already thinking about developing a perfume. And he tragically dies. And so after he dies, she really throws herself into launching a perfume. By then, she's already a famous designer, right? She's already
started
very
as a hat maker and then on from there.
Exactly. And that by, you know, by 1919, she's already well known as a fashion designer. And so she starts dating, as you said, Dmitry Pavlovich, who's one of the exiled white Russians and a former Grand Duke. And she's working on developing this perfume. And what we think happened is that Dmitry said to her one day, oh, you want a perfume? You know, there was this perfume when I was at the court in Russia that my aunt, the Tsarina, really loved, Bouquet de Catherine. You know, funny, just down the way, the perfumer, Ernest Beau, also now in exile from Russia after the revolution, is working for a company there. How about I introduce you to him?
Uh-huh.
She meets Ernest Beau and says, I want to develop a signature perfume. She's one of the very first designers to do this, the third in history, not the first, but the third. And the famous story is, of course, that Ernest Beau gives her 10 different samples and she chooses the fifth vial.
What was it about that vial? Were they similar? Were they all different? Were they tiny variations on a theme?
Yeah, the 10 variations were all different reformulations of Bouquet de Catherine, you know, also known as Rowlett No. 1. Mm-hmm. And so they were 10 different reformulations, and we think that there were two different series. There was 1 to 5, and then there was, you know, a 21 to 25. And that so there were two kind of different ways in which he thought about reformulating it. And what he said about how he reformulated it is that he had been sent to the very, very northern reaches of Russia during the First World War. And he said that he always remembered the scent of black earth in Russia and the scent, the note of snow melting on black earth. He said that was what he was trying to go for in revising the, you know, the number series in order to transform, you know, Rowlett No. 1 into what became the number, Chanel No. 5, the 10 samples.
Snow melting on black earth, which sounds like a very, very singular chemical sort of presentation as well. I mean, snow, the crystalline stuff, everything that's going on. Of course, we know that these specials, but bring those together. You've really got something.
Yeah, no, it's an amazing, almost poetic image. Mm-hmm. I mean, for me, that's one of the things like that I love learning more about the perfume history is the way in which perfumers do not get their due as artists, I would say. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's an incredibly poetic sensibility sometimes. So he makes the perfume. The famous story is, what are you going to name it, he says to her later. It's an interview that he says this. And she says, well, Chanel No. 5 has always been my lucky number. Mm-hmm. And so we'll let this perfume keep its name. It was the fifth sample. Mm-hmm. No. 5 was her magic number, she believed. And so that was how it became Chanel No. 5. So this is 1920. Mm-hmm. 1921, she launches it in her boutiques. And she's only selling it in her boutiques, but it's an immediate success. So she goes and she talks to a man named Théophile Badet, who runs the Galerie Lafayette, and the big department store in Paris. Mm-hmm. And she says, would you be willing to distribute, you know, sell my perfume? And he says, sure, but what you really need if we're going to scale up, you know, distribution of this scent that's already a cult favorite in Paris is you're going to need to work with a perfume manufacturer and distributor. Mm-hmm. And he says, how about I introduce you to some friends and some partners, a family named the Wertheimers, mm-hmm. who owned a very, very important perfume house, manufacturing company and distribution company called Bourjois. And so okay. In 1924, Chanel, and it's one of the most, it's one of those amazing entrepreneurial meetings in, you know, in really in business history.
Coco Chanel with Pierre and Paul of Wertheimer.
Yeah, and they meet and they make a deal. And Chanel says, distribute my perfume and all I want is 10%. And you take it, you deal with it, it's your perfume. I want veto power if I don't think something's luxurious enough, mm-hmm. and I want 10% okay. of the profits. Otherwise, you know, you do what you want to do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they make this bargain. And what happens is the Wertheimers get 70%, she takes 10%, and Théophile Badet takes 20% as a finder's fee of the company.
Wow.
So you think about this moment. You know, she's basically just signed away. She's just signed away rights to a perfume.
Her greatest creation.
Yeah. I mean, it's and I think the reason she did it is that she was so worried that that anybody would be able to have any say over the fashion house, which is what she really thought about as where her identity was invested. And as you can imagine, then they begin to distribute Chanel No. 5, and they actually begin to distribute in what I always have thought is a completely madcap marketing strategy. They launch it in 24, Chanel No. 5, but they also launch a whole series of other Chanel perfumes at the same time. Chanel No. 1, Chanel No. 2, 7, 11, 14, 20, 21, 22.
Place.
So it's, it's this absolutely insane marketing strategy as far as I can tell, right?
And then politics and war began to intervene with the rise of Nazism in Germany. The Wertheimers were Jewish. The Germans come to France. They have to get out, and things get really complicated.
They get incredibly complicated, in part because Coco Chanel is, I think it, it pains me to say this, but I think the truth is that she's pretty anti-Semitic in her sensibilities. I mean, there are memos that she writes after the Wertheimers flee. The Wertheimers and, the heirs of the Bade family are all Jewish, and they all end up having to either flee France or, one member of the Heilbronn family ends up getting sent to Buchenwald.
The Wertheimers get to New York. Lucky for them, Estee Lauder sets them up, and pretty soon they're making Chanel No. 5 in Hoboken, and you've got this kind of transatlantic thing. Did Coco Chanel try and use German Nazi-era laws against Jewish ownership to wrest this back from them?
Yeah, she writes their letters where she says, they're Jewish, give the company back to me.
Wow.
And luckily the Wertheimers had sold all the partners at Chanel No. 5 had sold the company in a compliance sale to an Aryan named Felix Amiot, who held it during the war.
Mm-hmm.
She wasn't successful, but she kept trying. And so what they did is they were in economic exile in the United States. As you say, they produced it in Hoboken. Her comment when she found out was, it's monstrous. They produced it in Hoboken. And they had this brilliant idea to sell it through the commissaries to the American GIs.
Yeah,
and that was really what transformed that into the luxury product of the Second World War.
Did she succeed in getting it back from them? Was she ashamed of trying on those grounds?
There's not any evidence that she's ashamed of having tried. I mean, we don't have any letter where she says, that was, my bad, shouldn't have done that. No. In fact, Chanel's history during the war is pretty complicated. I mean, for Americans, the Second World War is so black and white, right? Was somebody a collaborator or not? For Europeans, there's shades and shades of gray. And in part, living in Paris during the Second World War was a dicey time. But, she lived in the Ritz Hotel during the Second World War with a German lover. And for me, actually, the more, complicated part of her story isn't even who she had as lovers, although she did have a series of fascist or pro-fascist lovers. But that in 1943, we know that she went to Berlin twice and was engaged in, I think, what she thought was covert diplomacy, but that to a lot of people after the war looked like something else.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about the story of Chanel No. 5, of all things, the classic scent, the perfume, its creation, its marketing. After all, this is a product, but scent is also powerful no matter where it emerges from. Tilar Matseo says, give perfumers their due. They're kind of artists with your olfactory senses, and we're warming up to that here today. She joins us from New York. Her new book is The Secret of Chanel No. 5. We're going to go into just a minute into perfume critic Tanya Sanchez, but we have so many callers and lots of interesting comments online. I'll get to those as well, and a little more of the story that we will get to. But first, Tina in Nashville, Tennessee. Tina, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
Quick story for you. Back in 1985,
yeah, we hope not.
I was visiting Paris as an exchange student,
yeah.
And of course we went to a parfumerie, and I could not leave there without picking something, but I had never selected my own fragrance, so it was sort of this coming-of-age moment.
How old were you, Tina, maybe?
I was 17.
Okay.
And I remembered, thank goodness, that Chanel No. 5 had always been part of my mother's inventory. And I thought, well, you can't go wrong with a classic. So that's what I picked. And it's very intimidating. You're surrounded by all these bottles and these very sophisticated French women who are determined to sell you something.
Yes.
And so I picked Chanel No. 5. And when you walk out the door in France, what they do is spray you from head to toe with whatever you've chosen.
You're anointed.
So I walk out into the streets of Paris feeling like a princess. And that's when you know you've made the right choice.
Tina, that's great. I love that story, and I want to get more. Thank you so much in Nashville. Thank you, Tina. One more from Beaufort, South Carolina. Anne, you're on the air, Anne.
Hello, Tom. Oh. I just wanted to share with you that over, well, about 60 years ago, I snuck into my grandmother's bedroom, and I opened that finely milled little glass stopper, and I put the perfume behind my ears, and I was just overwhelmed. It was magic, and I've worn it ever since.
60 years ago, you have a very young voice, my dear Anne.
Well, thank you.
Wow. And this was Chanel No. 5, and it was
it
your
was
grandmother's.
Chanel
and
No. 5.
But you didn't want to run from it because it was grandma's? You were happy to have it as your own.
I was. And, you know, I put a little bit on a cotton ball and put it in, wrapped it up in a little bit of paper and took it home, and I kept smelling it again and again. So I knew that when I got old enough, I would definitely buy this stuff. And I'd like to thank you, by the way, for this story. It's wonderful.
It really is interesting to hear and to see how so many people have incorporated it. Scent is powerful. We become accustomed to something, and this is a special one. And that's a lot of years in your life. Thank you so much, Anne. And one more right here, Martine, calling from Lexington, Virginia. Martine, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
I just wanted to give a different perspective. I don't mean it to sound negative, but I'm the daughter of a French Army, World War II Army bride.
Okay.
And the attitude there was that Chanel No. 5, once they started sending it home to American women, French women didn't want to wear it. They felt that it was just for American women, and they went to the other Chanels.
And, that is interesting. If all the GIs have it, they're going to go somewhere else. That's very
exactly.
French, wonderfully so.
American women, we want our own.
I love that story, Martine. Thank you very much. Tilar, what do you know about that? Did it stay popular in France, or did they say, oh, no, it's become common, you know, global common?
No, Martine makes a good point. You know, one of the things about Chanel No. 5 is that the primary marketing always in the beginning, once it began to be distributed, was in the North American markets. It wasn't even advertised in France regularly until the 1940s. So the United States was the huge market of the mid-20th century, and that was where that was the economic crucible in which Chanel No. 5 became this bestseller. Without the American market, it would not have become what it did. So Martine is right. I have and I have no doubt that some French women would have decided not to have purchased it because, you know, remember what it would have been like to have been a French woman during the Second World War. Chanel kept the perfume house on Rue Cambon across the street from the Ritz Hotel, just off the Place Vendôme, open. And during the war, what you would have seen had you lived there during the occupation were German soldiers and German generals lining up to buy luxury goods that at a moment when, you know, I think the statistic is 20% of French people living in Paris didn't have enough food. So now, that's not the fault of Chanel No. 5. I mean, I should say, you know, in the end, the Jewish families triumphed. They did keep control, amazingly, of the Chanel No. 5.
What was the deal they cut with her to finally just settle this and be done with it?
Well, you know, amazingly, during the war, because they had done the compliance sale to Felix Amiot, the Aryan friend, the courts actually found that Felix Amiot was the rightful owner and not Chanel. And so at the end of the war, Amiot gave it back to the investors. And so to this day, the Wertheimer family still owns Chanel. So there's, you know, there's no reason in the world why anybody cannot buy Chanel No. 5 to one's heart's delight with very, very good conscience.
And Coco's interest in it after the war, after that was all worked out?
She was really angry to have obviously lost control of it. And so what she did is she actually then put out a series of perfumes called the Red Label Perfumes, where she did her own version of Chanel No. 5 and started sending out the word that the Chanel No. 5 made by the partners was bad perfume, and she tore it down. You shouldn't buy that perfume anymore. You should buy mine. And she really, in order to get the partners to renegotiate and to give her more money, she basically tries to destroy the prestige of Chanel No. 5.
We've got culture, business here, history, politics, sexual politics. Here's a question on that front from Holly online. She says, why was the term mistress used in the description of this accomplished woman during the promos for this show? Seems rather sexist. If you were doing a promo for a show on JFK, would you have opened by describing him as a Lothario? Holly, we know that history of JFK. You tell this history of Coco Chanel. Was it a matter of shame to her? Was it up front? What about the sexual politics around her and her perfume?
Yeah, no, I think it's an interesting point. I think, unfortunately, the fact is that her own illegitimacy as a child, because her parents were not married when she was born, and the fact that she was in what was known as one of the grand horizontales, you know, one of the great horizontal women. And, you know,
meaning a woman who made her way with sexuality.
Horizontally, exactly. And so...
was that an insult? Would she have to take that as a wounding insult?
It was the reason why the men that she loved wouldn't marry her in the end. I mean, so this is the answer to the listener's question. The reason it's important is that that decision to become the mistress or the kept woman or, you know, whatever term you want to have, I appreciate the way in which that is gendered.
And the circumstances in which she found herself.
Right. But the reality is that more than anything shaped the destiny of her life, because she fell in love with... You know, when she was in love with Boy Capel, what the movie, you know, Coco Avant Chanel or Coco Before Chanel leaves out, it looks like it's this tragic love affair where he dies and they were going to get married. The truth is, before he died, he had just said to her, I am not going to marry you because I'm not going to marry my mistress. I'm marrying a respectable woman. Do you want to stay my mistress? Mm. And she was thinking about it at the moment that he died.
Wow.
So he wouldn't – and there's a heartbreaking quote where Chanel says, we were in love. We could have gotten married. And we didn't, because you don't marry your mistress.
So
that happened to her over and over.
It's even tougher than sexual politics here. This goes right to her heart. Tilara, please stand by. Tanya Sanchez joins us right now from Boston. She's a writer and perfume critic, co-author of Perfumes, The Guide. Tanya Sanchez, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me on, Tom.
Think for us for a minute about Chanel No. 5 and the whole universe of scent of perfume that's out there. Where do you see this one, and why do you think it's lasted? It's sort of is symbol iconography. Its fact has lasted so long. Is it the perfume itself? Is it the story? The marketing? What do you see in this one, Tanya?
Well, everybody talks about the marketing, but it's clear that marketing will make you buy a perfume once, but never again. So it's got to be in the bottle. The weird thing about Chanel No. 5 to me is that at the time, there were a lot of mixed bouquet floral fragrances. And the floral inside Chanel No. 5 is actually a fairly pedestrian fragrance. There were a lot that kind of smelled like that. It was the aldehydes that made it stand out as a smell, and it's what we recognize. That's what made it very modern at the time. Since then, the reason it's lasted is because the Wertheimer family is so committed to quality. They are famous in the fragrance industry for their obsession with quality. The perfume hasn't changed. While its rivals have slowly cheapened out, dropped out, no longer smell like themselves, have been discontinued, it's sort of the last man standing.
Well, I wonder about that. I've got a question here online. It says, this is from Jemima. I have the most vivid memory of my glamorous mother, imagine January Jones in Mad Men, we're prepared to do that, getting ready to go out and adding Chanel No. 5 as her final touch. Nowadays, she writes to us, I wear it and it's still my fave, but I feel like the scent has changed, become less delicate and sensual. Have they changed the formula, or is it just me? Talar, I'll put that first to you.
No, I mean, I've spoken, Tanya, you might know differently, but I've spoken with Jacques Polge and Christopher Sheldrake, who are the perfumers, in-house perfumers at Chanel. And really what Tanya is saying is exactly the case. You know, I went down to Grasse and saw the rose harvest, and it's an obsession with with quality. And so there have been obviously changes historically where things like certain synthetic musks at one point were no longer allowed by the industry, but those are all not recent changes. There have been no recent changes to the formula, and
well,
Chanel No. 5
Can I
yes, Tanya, please, yes.
This is a very contentious issue among people who are mad about Chanel No. 5, and it's very contentious for me. The perfumers at Chanel have been committed to making sure that this fragrance is the same year after year. And because it has a lot of naturals, that includes changing the actual formula, of course, because when the jasmine isn't quite the same, one year you've got to beef it up somewhere else, this sort of thing. So there's that. So every year, of course, they are working very hard, trimming the sails, trying to make sure it smells the same. But the other major problem has been regulatory. And up until only about 15, 20 years ago, it wasn't such a big problem. They did have to make a huge change with the musk.
But what do you mean regulatory? How do regulations come in?
Well, they don't put the full ingredients for the perfume on the label, and the reason they can do that is because the fragrance industry self-regulates, and they test to make sure everything's safe. I don't know anybody who's died from wearing Chanel No. 5 myself. Right now, in fact, in preparation for the show, I have a pre-50s Chanel No. 5 on my left wrist, and I have a bottle from just a few years ago on my right wrist.
Oh, perfume critic, go. Sniff and, sniff
and
tell.
I have to tell you, they're really not the same, and the big difference is the musks. The old one is extremely animalic, and I think Tilar talks about this some in her book.
What does that mean, animalic?
Animalic notes are animal notes, like musk, which originally comes from the musk deer, although the nitro musks are the synthetic version of that, which are now no longer in Chanel No. 5. But also there is a civet, which comes from a very strange beast, which excretes it.
Yeah.
You've got ambergris, which comes from whales. These are things that smell sort of dirty. And number five has
dirty, but
that,
great.
The perfumes of that time all did.
Mm-hmm.
The one on my right wrist does not have those things. And while I don't want the musk deer to die, and while I'm glad the nitro musks, if they really are neurotoxic, as everyone decided, are gone, It's really not the same. I mean, it's still beautiful. You can still see the shape, but it's like the difference between a watercolor and an oil painting.
Wow. I don't know. I think back to the first time I smelled it on a girl named Luann, and I think the animalic was very strong.
Those haven't been
very good
changes,
way.
Have they?
Say what?
All
sorry.
The different formulas, the perfume concentration and the eau de toilette and the eau de parfum are actually slightly different. So people who think that something has changed should make sure they're smelling the same one.
Tanya, is there a different profile to the perfumes that are very popular among young women today? Are there fashions that...
Yes, of course. I mean, fashions do change. But Chanel No. 5 has had a lot of grandkids. So a lot of the perfumes that we love today are actually directly related. I think Estee Lauder's Pleasures is actually a sort of descendant of this sort of thing. It's this smell of sparkle and soap with all the animal taken out at that point.
We love it. Tanya Sanchez, we're going to think of you all day today with today's number five on one wrist and decades ago on the other. Co-author of Perfumes, The Guide. It's really good of you to be with us. Thank you so much, Tanya, for your
time. Thank you.
One last call from Salt Lake City, Utah. Marjorie. Hi, Marjorie. Our time is short, but you're on the air.
Well, hello, Tom, and thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I just have a comment and a question. The first time I ever saw Chanel No. 5 was when I was growing up in Wisconsin, and it was in our little drugstore he had wonderful perfumes and wonderful things for lady, a whole section.
Mm.
And so that, that's always stuck with me, because if you went to Mr. Stebbins' drugstore, you could get really fine stuff.
Living high.
Question. Yeah. The question I have is, I had heard the French say you shouldn't dab it on, you should spray up in the air with your atomizer, and it should come down on you. And how did Chanel put it on, and how should it be put on?
Oh, great question. It's like shampoo twice. You'll use a lot if you have to walk through a cloud of it. What about Coco? Do you know how she put it on, Tilar?
Well, Coco, late in her life, we know that in her apartment at the Ritz, she had household servants who went around spraying it everywhere. So I've never heard for sure whether she personally, when she put it on herself, dabbed it or sprayed it. But we know that she perfumed her apartment with it by spraying it with an atomizer. And believed that, it, as you say, you know, that the, I was struck by the caller earlier who said, you know, that they put it up and down you on your body when you buy it at the perfume stores in Paris. And so I think there is in French culture an idea that perfume is something we live with in, you know, much higher proportions in some ways. So you, you know, perfume your house with your scent. That said, late in her life, you know, after the war, Chanel stopped wearing Chanel No. 5, and she instead ended up wearing the perfume that we now know as Chanel No. 19. So there
as
was
a matter of competition with her, with the one that she once owned and then did not really.
Well, that's exactly it. You know, there's some evidence that Chanel No. 19 is what was originally one of the perfumes, the red label perfumes that got reformulated in the 70s. But no, she said at some point that she got tired of, you know, not having her own unique scent because everybody was wearing Chanel No. 5.
You know all about Chanel No. 5. Do you wear it, Tilar?
I do, and I there's a lighter version of it, actually, called Au Premier, which is the one that I wear, which is, like Tanya was saying, you know, that there are a lot of grandchildren of Chanel No. 5, including a very recent one made by Chanel.
Well, talk about a tantalizing scent and a really tantalizing story. We're grateful to you for bringing it to us in such exquisite detail. The book is The Secret of Chanel No. 5, The Intimate History of the World's Most Famous Perfume. Tilar, we're out of time. We could go on and on, but thank you so much for the story, for this history.
Such a pleasure. Thanks.
Tilar Matseo in New York. We'll go out with a little Yves Montand. Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Ceux qui s'aiment tout doucement sans faire de bruit. Et la mer efface sur le sable les pas des amants, des yeux.